So next Monday, the event that those who've seen one say will bring you to your knees in awe, make crickets chirp in the middle of the day, the total solar eclipse. Some people are paying $35,000 for a day-long plane ticket and an unobstructed view. At Sky Village in Arizona, every resident has pledged to use blackout shades to get the full effect. But what did people think before science could predict an eclipse and the sky suddenly went dark? Brian Brewer addresses that question and more in his book, Eclipse. Brian, welcome.
It's nice to be here.
Well, as we're going to hear, people reacted in all different ways when a total solar eclipse happened. But when was the first reference to a solar eclipse that we know?
Well, it was about 4,000 years ago in China. There was the Chinese astronomers kept accurate records. We have our first actual documentation of an eclipse. I think it was 2134.
2134 BCE.
Correct.
And from the writings that we found, it says the sun and the moon did not meet harmoniously. This was not thought to be a good thing.
Definitely not. In ancient times, in Chinese cultures and many other cultures around the world, eclipses were viewed as omens of doom. This was a negative message.
Well, and there was a lot of thinking that a dragon, I think, was eating the sun.
Yes. And the same thing goes with a lunar eclipse. They applied the same mythology to lunar eclipses as well.
Talk more about other places in the world and their importance in the history of eclipses. Stonehenge was actually thought to be, what, an early sort of stone computer?
Yes. Most people, when they see Stonehenge or read about it or see pictures, they focus on the stones that are in the center of the monument. But surrounding the monument are a ring of 56 holes in the ground that are filled with chalk. They're evenly spaced holes. Amateur astronomer John Aubrey discovered these, and in the mid-20th century, several astronomers came up with a theory about how these 56 holes could have been used as a sort of a big cosmic clock, you might say, that's laid out on the ground. By moving stones around to mark the movement of the sun and the moon and the nodes of the lunar orbit, you could predict when an eclipse occurs.
How many years ago, and even if it was crude, were scientists or astronomers able to predict an eclipse?
Well, the Chinese mentioned earlier, 2000 BCE, and as well as the Babylonian astronomers kept very accurate records about the movements of celestial objects. The Babylonians, in the same general time frame, were able to come up with this 18-year Saros, S-A-R-O-S, Saros cycle that astronomers even use today to predict the recurrence of eclipses. But predictions have been somewhat crude until the middle of the 1800s. Before that, astronomers could get a general sense of maybe what day an eclipse was going to occur, but didn't have much information about where you were going to be able to see a total solar eclipse. That all changed in the mid-1800s when several things happened. There was a mathematician who came up with some equations that make it much easier to calculate the orbital motion of the moon and the sun, of the Earth, to be able to predict eclipses. And then another astronomer spent most of his adult lifetime calculating the paths for total solar eclipses for a period of about 3,000 years. His name is Theodor von Oppolzer, and he published his Canon of Solar Eclipses in the late 1800s. And with that change, astronomers and the public as well, who had access to that information, were able to get a much better prediction of when and where a total solar eclipse was going to occur.
Yeah. Talk about some of the impacts of ancient eclipses. I mean, I can't imagine what people thought. And you say that the most famous eclipse of ancient times ended a war.
That's right. In 585 BC, there were two Middle Eastern armies, the Lydians and the Medes. They were in battle one day, and unbeknownst to them in advance, they were right in the path of a total solar eclipse that day. And so when the moon covered the sun and it went dark, the warring factions took note and they laid down their arms and they made peace right on the spot.
By the way, you tell us that those fighters not only put down their weapons and had a peace treaty, but they sealed it with a double marriage.
A double marriage, yes.
That's how freaked they were. But you write, the lunar eclipse in 413 BCE had a different outcome on the Peloponnesian War.
Yes. In that case, on one side, the astronomers predicted that there was going to be a lunar eclipse, and the Athenians took it as a bad sign, and so they delayed their preparations for war, which gave the opposing side, the Syracusans, a chance to regroup, and then the Syracusans defeated the Athenians. So in that case, the military commander hesitated and lost.
Because he listened to a soothsayer.
Exactly.
We told him to wait. You say we've been able to verify for certain the date of an eclipse mentioned in the Bible.
Yes, it's from Amos chapter 8, verse 9 that says, "And on that day, says the Lord God, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight." Based on other information about what was going on at the time, historians were able to go back in time and they were able to fix the date as June 15th, 763 BCE.
Wow.
And even today, as new historical records come to light that mention eclipses, it's kind of like a time marker that we have for over the millennia. And historians have found it very useful to go back and fix the dates and get a better idea of the chronology of certain events.
It's really interesting to see how some of the ancient bleeds into the modern, because you said you went to Brazil once.
I led an eclipse tour to Brazil in 1994, and we chose a location kind of out in the countryside. And I was up on a little hill during totality, and sure enough, we could hear in the distance gunshots. And the locals said, "We're firing the guns to scare the dragon away so that the sun will come back." Hmm. So those beliefs and customs survive even today.
And Christopher Columbus used what he knew would be beliefs to his advantage.
Yes. On his fourth voyage to the Americas, this was in 1504, he got stranded in Jamaica. The natives fed him and his crew for a while, but after a few months, they got tired of it and withheld the food. Columbus knew from his navigational and astronomical tables that there was going to be a total lunar eclipse, and this was on February 29th, 1504. And so shortly before the beginning of the eclipse, he called the natives together and said, "Hey, if you don't resume feeding us, I'll make the moon disappear." And they scoffed at him at first, but then he retired to his cabin, and sure enough, the moon started to disappear, and the natives relented. They fed him until he got rescued by the other ships from Europe.
That doesn't seem quite fair, but...
Well, that's the power of knowledge.
Well, you know, speaking of which, eventually, eclipses helped us learn more about our universe. You say the eclipse helped prove Einstein's theory of relativity.
Yes. One of the things he postulated in his theory was that light would be bent by gravity. Back then, there was no way to test it on Earth. But they realized that during a total solar eclipse, the light coming from a star that was very near the apparent location of the sun in the sky would actually be bent by passing next to the sun. And you could measure its location during an eclipse. And then months later, when the moon was in a different part of the sky, they could measure, again, the relative position of the star, and sure enough, they proved that the position changed, and it was changed just according to what Einstein calculated. So it was the first empirical proof of the theory of relativity.
There you go. So there's that. But why else does this have such a hold on us? There's a section of your book titled "The Experience of Awe."
Robin, that's a great question because I have been thinking about that for decades. And in the last 10 or 15 years, psychologists have begun to study this emotion called awe. And awe is certainly something that eclipse chasers know about. For one, the view of the solar corona is just magnificent. Secondly, this eerie daytime darkness it's just really strange. Mm-hmm. And third, I think that often people get kind of a visceral sense of this cosmic alignment. You're standing right in the shadow of the moon where with the sun 93 million miles away, the moon 240,000 miles away, and it's casting this narrow band of shadow right in the earth. And you're standing right there. So you're in perfect alignment on a truly cosmic scale.
So where are you going to be?
We have plans to be in Sun Valley, Idaho, which is in the path of totality. One piece of advice I'd like to give people who are going to be in the path of totality is don't try to use your smartphone camera to try to take a picture of the eclipse. It will be very unsatisfying. It'll be just a little tiny dot on the screen. What I tell people is the best way to use your smartphone is right after totality. Take short videos to record people's reactions because most people just typically get blown away by it.
You'll see it in their face. Brian Brewer, his book is Eclipse, the third edition. He's the go-to guy for eclipse watching, and we really appreciate you looking backwards for us. Thank you.
My pleasure.